was quick. Thank you, Billy, for asking. And it is an honor and a privilege to be invited to participate, you know, in your home group and in any meeting. And I'm really grateful. My name is Christina and I am an alcoholic. So I want to just start out by telling you my sobriety date is June 19th, 1993. My home group is Pockets of Enthusiasm here in Brecksville. We meet on Thursday nights at 7:30 in the evening. We are currently not meeting because of COVID, and we are not meeting on Zoom, unfortunately. So I'm so eager to get back to our meeting. My sponsor is Pat Y, and she's been sponsoring me for about a year now, and I'm so grateful for that lady and her guidance and direction. She, like I said, she's been sponsoring me a short time, and my longtime sponsor, her name was Beth Gordon. She passed away last year around this time, right before COVID hit, and she passed away with 48 years of sobriety. So so I kind of grew up with, you know, Akron AA, with long timers. And I'm so grateful for our long timers. You know, I'm so grateful for old timers. You know, I think you old timers is, you know, it's not really accurate because you can have somebody who comes in very young and still be an old timer. But I love our old timers. I love listening to their stories, you guys. I love listening to the things that, you know, they share about, you know, our history here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, like I said, I, you know, earlier talking to Billy, I'm from the Akron area. So every year I'm at Founders Day, and just a few years back, I was at Founders Day weekend. It was Sunday morning. So we were finishing up the Sunday morning meeting and I was heading over to Dr. Bob's house because my husband volunteers over there. And he was caught up in the work that he has to do over there in the business house next door to Dr. Bob's. So I went over to Dr. Bob's. I walked into the living room and there was an old timer standing there talking to a couple of guys. And it just so happened that this old timer who was in the living room talking was the longest standing member of the sobriety countdown for Founders Day weekend that weekend. And he had 67 years of sobriety. And it was amazing. And he was regaling us with all these stories about what it was like when he got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys, he knew many of the early founding members of AA, and he knew Dr. Bob and he knew Bill Wilson. And, you know, after a while, you know, listening to him share his stories, you know, people are coming in from all over the world to see Dr. Bob's at this point. And they're not really realizing what they're walking into until they stop and listen. And after a while, we all were gathered around, many people crammed in that little living room. He's sitting on his couch. And I sat at that old timer's knees on the floor listening to him for about an hour and a half. And then we asked him how old he was. And he said he didn't know how old he was, you know, 67 years, right? And how do you not know how old you are? And so we asked him that, and he told us another story about how back in the day, you know, we're talking a long time ago, 100 years ago. Back in the day, people were pretty private, and his mother might have been, he said, a little vain. And she didn't want people to know how old she was. So she didn't bother to tell him how old he was, and he didn't seem to mind and didn't skip a beat. And so when we asked him what Social Security goes by, he said 105, you know, and why that story is so incredible to me and why I like to share that is that that old timer at 67 years of sobriety at 105 years old, and mind you, he's from Santa Barbara, California, sitting in Akron, Ohio. He's not at home sitting on his couch watching TV. He is in Akron, Ohio, sharing his experience, strength, and hope. He was giving it away. And that's a powerful message for me, you know. And, you know, I have a friend, well, I had a friend up in the Toronto, Canada area that I loved dearly. He was a longstanding member of AA. He had many, many years. And I got word he passed away, and I was heartbroken. And I called my grand sponsor at the time, and I said, "Pat, we're losing our old timers." And she had 58 years of sobriety, you know, she's lost all her old timers, but these are my old timers. And I said, "Pat, we're losing our old timers." And she said, "Well, Christina, you know, guess what? It's time. It's time to pass that baton on to the next generation. And guess what? It's your turn." And I was expressing, you know, my feelings of inadequacy on such a task. And she just chuckled as she does. And she spurted out, you know, "Don't worry, you don't have to worry about a thing because all the instructions are already written out for you." And after, you know, 27 years of sobriety, I can complicate something so simple. Thank God for good sponsorship. So, you know, if you're new and you're sitting in this room, I want to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works well. And what was working for that old timer 67 years ago, when he walked through the doors of AA, was working for my grand sponsor at 58 years, my longtime sponsor, Beth, at, you know, 49 years ago now it would have been. And, you know, it was working for me 27 years ago when I walked through the doors. And I promise you, if you're willing to take steps, take action, and take direction in Alcoholics Anonymous, this thing will work for you too. I want to welcome the newcomer to Alcoholics Anonymous, and buckle up, because this thing is, it's a ride worth staying. And it is a wonderful new way of life. I want to talk about identification. I always like to talk about it because I think it's so very important. I didn't understand what identification was. When I got here, you know, I didn't know how to identify, and I would sit in the rooms and I would listen to people share their stories, and I would listen for all the differences, none of the similarities. And I almost compared myself right out of the rooms. And the spirit of identification is the crux of this beautiful program and fellowship, because we come from all walks of life, you know, and we come from different socioeconomic, cultural backgrounds, you know, and we all bring to the table in Alcoholics Anonymous such diversity and experience. So as I share my story with you tonight and talk about my trouble may not look like your trouble. You know, it might not look like Billy's trouble or Sam's trouble, but trouble does not identify me as an alcoholic. It has nothing to do with it. You know, it's just a byproduct of drinking behavior. What makes me an alcoholic, you guys, is I have an allergy of body, an obsession of mind. And I'm described in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, right? You know, I cannot safely predict what's going to happen when I put a drink into my body. You know, all bets are off. And so it took me a long time to figure out what, you know, when I sit in the rooms and I listen to someone share, you know, I wanna identify with the message, not so much the messenger. I want to listen for how we drank, how we lived, how we thought, and how we felt. These four things, that's identification, you know, and it's the, you know, it's the crux of this program. And it's also where we find the hope. You know, and I believe, you know, if you're sitting in this room right now, as we all are, that we've already been given this gift. It's already been given to us, and we don't have to give it back. It's like water that flows down to Earth's deepest and darkest crevices. God's grace and mercy flows down to our dark places and then lifts us up, you guys, to the sunlight of the Spirit. And then we're given this beautiful gift. We get this. And I used to question why some of us get this thing, you know, and some of us don't. Why I'm here with you tonight at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And over the years, I've watched people I care about walk out those doors, never to return, to meet certain and uncertain death, right? And I used to question why him and not me, you guys, and why me and not him. But over the years, I have come to realize that those questions and those answers are really none of my business. They're God's business, not mine. You know, and in my humanity, I am not capable of understanding the answers to those questions, you know, and perhaps I'm just asking all the wrong questions. I do know what my business is today. You know, I've been given this gift. You know, I have accepted this gift, and I need to do the things that you taught me to do even more so today at 27 years than when I first got here. I need to follow those directions and follow your example. A friend, old friend, and a dear member of Alcoholics Anonymous, she died sober. She passed away some years ago. She used to talk about that gift. And I'm going to share with you exactly what she used to share, because it's such a great little story. But she would talk about getting this beautiful present. It was wrapped in beautiful paper with a beautiful bow, and it was a gift from her higher power. And as she was unwrapping this gift, she was imagining how beautiful it was going to be. And where she was going to display it. Was she going to put it on the mantle in the living room or on a shelf somewhere so people could admire it, so she could look at it in its beauty and be grateful, you know? And as she opened up that box and lifted the lid, she discovered not something beautiful. She discovered something quite opposite. She discovered work boots. And I love that story, you guys, because when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we do not put our sobriety on a shelf to admire, right? We get busy and we put on our work boots. And, you know, I find God in the trenches of Alcoholics Anonymous. My parents were great parents. They taught me morals and values. They gave me everything that I needed, everything that I wanted. And somewhere around 4 years of age, my mom and my dad sat me and my younger sister down and told us they were getting a divorce. And I watched my dad walk out the door that day. And for the first time in my little life, I experienced fear and uncertainty. And this fear would become the backdrop of delusional thinking and skewed perspective that would drive my thoughts and my feelings and my drinking. You know, in Bill's story, he talks about impending calamity, and I understand impending calamity. I was always living on that edge. I was afraid of what was around that next corner. If things were good, I knew that they were going to turn bad. And if things were bad, they were just going to get worse, you know, but woven beautifully within the instructions of our steps, it says, you know, He enables us to match calamity with serenity. And I know exactly where my solution lies today. My father, you know, shortly after he left home that day, he was in a car accident. My dad was a big drinker. He was drunk from a wedding, and he wrapped his car around a telephone pole and nearly died. And I remember finding out that he was in the hospital. And at that moment, I swore I would never be like that, because I couldn't understand how someone I love so much could go out and do something like that. And I always felt, you guys, less than, not pretty enough, not smart enough. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in, watching everybody live their lives. I felt like I didn't get the memo that would tell you how to talk with others. My tongue would get thick. My thoughts wouldn't come, you know, how to be and act. And my peers seemed to maneuver through childhood and adolescence with ease and comfort, while I, on the other hand, would feel ill at ease and awkward and uncomfortable in my own skin. And you guys, I wasn't a finisher. I didn't finish anything I started. And I knew something was wrong with me then. My first drink changed everything. I remember like it was yesterday. I remember everything about that first drink. It was a warm beer. My sister and I stole some beers, shoved them under the couch. And when my mom and my new stepdad went to bed that night, we had a friend over and we pulled out those beers. And I remember drinking that first beer. It went down kind of rough. It tasted terrible. It was warm. But shortly thereafter, you know, I had that warm, fuzzy feeling, you know, and it radiated through my body and down to my fingertips and toes. And then it went right up to my head. And all of a sudden, I was enough. I could talk to you. My tongue was no longer thick. I was laughing. I wasn't uptight. You know, I found magic that night. I found magic. And, you know, I started to get into trouble. And I didn't see I was getting into the trouble that I was getting into, because the people I was hanging out with, the kids that I was partying with, they were doing all the same things I was, you know. And mom, get off my case. My dad, you know, I lived with him my senior year in high school, and he would let me have the car on the weekends as long as I would drop him off at the bars. And there's an area in Cleveland on a road called Brook Park Road. And he would frequent these bars. But these bars, it was this particular strip of Brook Park Road consisted of dark, dank dives and gentlemen clubs. And he would have me drop him off at one of these dives. And I'd go off and have the party because I had the car. And 9 times out of 10, I would usually, unless something happened or I was pretty toasted, I would pick him up at closing. That was the deal. And one night stands out. I remember walking into the bar to pick him up. It was 2:30, and there was a couple on the dance floor dancing the last dance. And there was a gentleman. Well, he probably wasn't a gentleman, but he was sitting drinking the last drink of the night. And I saw my dad in the corner of that bar, and he had his back against the wall, and he was sitting at a round table. And he had his hand cupped around that glass and his eyes lost in that drink. And it took me a long time to figure out what it was about that moment, you guys, that seared in my memory. And today I know that was the moment that I realized that alcohol had my dad. And once again, I swore I would never be like that. But little did I know, I was already well on my way of my own alcoholism. And my father was an alumni of Ohio University, and he wanted his oldest daughter to follow in his footsteps. And all the plans were made. And my senior year, I was doing a lot of partying, you know, and as you can imagine, you know, I'm sure you all know that when you do a lot of partying, you kind of miss a few things. And my grades and my class attendance suffered, and I didn't earn the necessary credits to walk across the stage with my peers. And my thought at the time was, so what? I'm not hurting anyone. And today I know that I robbed my parents of the right and the privilege and the joy to watch their oldest daughter walk across that stage to make that milestone. But I scrounged up those credits in summer school. And I walked into an empty high school. It was the end of August, I think, back in the day. And I picked up my high school diploma. And off to school I went. And let it be known that Ohio University is a nationally known prep school for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had arrived, you guys. The bars were all in walking distance, and my parents were 5 hours away, and the party was on. And after, you know, I got to tell you, I had to declare a major, and my major, I chose to pursue a major in dance. I took this audition. I didn't have any dance experience, but I was on kick line and in the dance group in high school, no technique. And I thought I'd give it a whirl. And they did. I did have a bad audition. They put me in a technique class, and I bombed that. Great, a big deal. It was terrible. Like I said, no technique. It was ballet. And then they gave me another opportunity. It was choreography class, and I nailed it. So I had this wonderful opportunity to study dance, and it's not a fluffy degree like you might think. It requires pre-med. So it was anatomy and physiology and kinesiology and biologies. And I had the academic piece and the creative piece all wrapped up into one fine major. And you guys, I found my passion, and I thought I found my future. But my drinking had other other plans. My alcoholism was going to take me in a whole different direction. And I really, for 2 years, I practiced my craft on the dance floor with a drink in my hand. And OU sent me packing, and I moved up to Ohio State University, and I was going to, shower them with all my talents. But I really just talked about that from the bar stools. And I'm apart from without you, in this program. And I started off on High Street, which is where all the college kids drank. And I quickly moved to the outskirts of town, in those dark, dark corners, those bars. That's just how I drank. And women were the enemy. I didn't get along with women. But there was one woman, her name was Cherokee, and she ran a traveling dance group, and she wanted me to join her troupe because, she knew that I had studied dance, if that's what you want to call it. And Cherokee, I still to this day do not think it was her real name. But the girls, they would travel to these dark, dank dives, and the girls would take off their clothes. And, this kind of dancing was beneath me because I'm a real dancer, right? And I didn't share these thoughts with the girls because there were always free drinks to be had, So I rode the wave as long as I could. And truth be told, though, I have a friend, her name's Kenna, and when she talks about the progression of this disease, she talks about how we lower our bar, and drop that bar again and again, and we seek out lower companions. And I would later sell out all my morals and values for the drink, and I would end up on Brook Park Road towards the end of my drinking, I am the queen of geographical cures. I could even do a geographic without going anywhere, and I did things like I tried to join Big Brothers and Big Sisters, and they wanted to see my place. And, you guys, I think at this point I'm trying to do something to change what I see going on in my life, the unmanageability. And I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to fix it. I think I'm fixing the insides by fixing the outsides, right? And this Big Brother and Big Sister thing didn't work out too well. They wanted to see my apartment, and it was a mess. My father used to say something to me. He used to say, Christina, the surroundings that you keep, the company that you keep, they're all a direct reflection of what's going on up here. And he was exactly right. And I was a mess. My life was a mess. I was a mess. Everything up here was a mess. I tried to join the church, the Catholic Church, the Columbus Diocese. And I have to tell you that Mother Superior did not find me a good match for the church. And I did successfully join the army. They took me. But as a direct result of my drinking, I got discharged from the army. And I was living in my car, and I was living in Cleveland on the streets in the middle of winter. And I'm starting to, my drinking's really getting the best of me. And it's taking me down that road very quickly. And I'm getting out of my car with my collie shepherd in the morning, and I'm brushing off all that fur, because we slept together in the back seat, and I'd let that poor dog pee, and then he lived and was prisoner in that car. And I would sneak into restaurant bathrooms and take a bird bath. And I was so afraid that you would see me. And I would move my car from street to street because I didn't want people to know that I was homeless and living in my car. My parents weren't going to take me back. And I would only hold a job for maybe 2 weeks. Long enough for a paycheck. And sometimes I didn't even go back for that, and I'd spent my nights in the bars, and I'm on a dead end street, and there's a brick wall in front of me, and I'm trying to, my dog's in the back, I'm drinking a six pack, and I'm trying to figure out how fast I need to plow that car into that wall and not survive. And I end up finishing that six pack. I end up at this bar, and there's two guys from high school that I run into there. And one of them finds out I'm living in my car, and invites me home to stay with him and his family. No questions asked, right? And his family consisted of his mom and his dad, his sister, her husband, and their children. And they opened their doors to me and welcomed me. And they had this dynamic about them that I absolutely was so attracted to. They were warm. They laughed. They talk to each other. And I always thought that was so beautiful. And I always thought I wanted that, you know, and I didn't think my family had that. And I used to tear my mother's heart out by telling her so and saying terrible things to her, like, and this isn't going to mean anything to you, but it definitely means something to me. And it for sure meant a lot to my mother when I would say cruel things like, why can't you be more like Julie Kitchen's mom? You know, and today I know I have the disease of perception. You know, I see things completely skewed. And I know that the problem was never my family. The problem is always me. And I have a wonderful family, and I know that today. But I'm sitting there, you know, I love their dinners, this family that took me in. They would have these warm dinners, and I would sit there at their dinner table in the dining room and just listen and bask in this, you know, in the middle of my alcoholism. And one night my drinking became a topic of discussion. And I found myself in a household of Alcoholics Anonymous because the young man's father was a member of AA. And he took me to my very first meeting. And that was a Thursday night meeting. And two things I remember about that night, it was smoky in that meeting basement. You guys were really happy. I don't remember anything else, but on the back of that, I went to another meeting on my own on Friday night. It was the West Clifton Group in Lakewood, Ohio, and it was 3,300 big. It was huge. I was very overwhelmed. I sat in the back. I got there late and I was leaving early, and I'm getting ready to turn on my heels, and I catch a look of somebody walking towards me, and he had a look on his face like he knew who I was, and I had no idea who this guy was, and he already thought it was my sister. She spent a year in Alcoholics Anonymous because her and I were drinking in Mexico, and she, in a blackout, jumped off the third story balcony of our hotel and nearly died. And so she ended up in AA, and he thought I was her at first, and he had these dark eyes and this dark hair. He's real handsome, and I took a hostage. And those would be the last two meetings I would go to for a while. I had distractions. And I wasn't ready, you know, and this young man, his name was Rick, and we had this crazy, turbulent, violent relationship. He had 9 years of sobriety, we had two beautiful children together. And in 1992, it was sweetest day, he came home with a bottle of champagne, and he said, honey, I think I was just too young. I think I can drink safely. And you guys, I didn't know anything about alcoholism or Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew this. I knew he was in trouble, but I do what I do. And he popped open that bottle of champagne and we drank it together. And my alcoholism just continued off in that direction. And his alcoholism picked up right where it left off 9 years ago. And then some, because of the progression, he went off in this direction and we didn't cross paths much. And my alcoholism took me to dark places, doing dark things with dark people. I burned so many bridges. I hurt my loved ones. And I emotionally and darn near physically abandoned my children. And the type of mother that I was when I came to you was this. I would come to often at 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, hungover, I'm sick. And my babies would be locked in their cribs. Their diapers would be saturated with urine and feces if they were still on their bodies. And they would be hungry for breakfast and their mother's love, you know. And I was just incapable of giving them all of the above. And I would leave them in situations with other people who would, you know, the idea was for them to care for them while I go out and have a drink, right? I would leave them to get to the drink because I didn't want to be like my dad, right? And so in my delusional thinking, leaving them with others was what I could do. And I would leave them in horrible situations and I would justify it. I remember the battle always in my head as I'm doing it, heading to the bar. And this battle would go on in my head between the drink and my babies. And I got to tell you guys, I love my children more than anything in the world. But you know who won that battle and you know who lost. And my children would lose every time to the drink. And there's an instance that I like to share because it's a good reminder for me. that I leave my kids with a couple to get to the drink, and they're in bad shape as it is. And my babies are unsupervised, and my youngest is 5 months old. I know this because he just starts to crawl. And he crawled himself behind their couch, and he became pinned, and he remained pinned behind this couch for over 5 hours. And newcomers, that's the type of mother that I am. When I put alcohol into my body, all bets are off, even my children. And so there's a series of events that occur that bring me to my last drunk. And my last drunk, I'm on the west side of Cleveland in some joint face down on a couch. And I'm coming to a voice, and the voice is my children's father. It's Rick. And he has my babies in his arms. And I'll never forget the words that he spoke. I'll never forget the look on his face when he spoke them. And I'll never forget, the tone of his voice as he plopped my children on my back. And he said, "Get up and be the mother that you are supposed to be to these children." And he turned around and he walked out. And at that moment, you guys, I knew that pitiful and comprehensible demoralization that our literature talks about. I scooped up those boys. I'm still drunk, and I put them in the car and I drive home. And you know, I believe that day that something was cracked open in me. And I was given a little bit of advance grace, because I don't know how long it was from the time that I got home to the time I said that prayer that we say that in the beginning of our journey here, that God help me prayer. And I said that prayer, and I picked up the phone and I called one of two women who reached out to me, and it was Janice. And she started taking me around to meetings and giving me direction and having me do things. Oh my gosh. And she had me standing at the door, welcoming newcomers, the girl who couldn't talk to people. And she, she had me setting up the meeting with her early, you know, way before the meeting started, and putting chairs up and tables and putting out the ashtrays. And after the meeting, we'd clean up and put chairs away, and I would have to clean ashtrays and making coffee. And what does cleaning ashtrays have to do with me staying sober anyway, right? But cleaning ashtrays has everything to do with staying sober, because all that early activity, it bought me time, you guys, to put the steps into my life. That activity takes me out of self long enough so that I can stay another day and put the steps into my life, and I'll be forever grateful. And so I started to, you know, get busy in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys told me some things, real crucial things that I'll never forget, like, all I needed was a mustard seed size of faith and willingness, and I could have what you had. And I didn't really know what that was, right? I don't know what you have. I just know that I need some relief, you know, and I'm running out of options. And you told me to suit up and show up, bring the body, and the mind will follow. I didn't have to think. That was okay with me. And, I started hanging out with these young people, and they started carting me off to meetings. And, I got sucked into going to a conference in Pennsylvania. These young people carted me up to Pennsylvania. We're in the back seat of this car. I remember sitting in the car drinking coffee. And for the first time, I recognized my mood to be light. I felt my mood lifted for the first time in such a long time. And somebody popped a cassette tape into the player, and a woman was sharing her story. And she started talking about those dark places that I had been and those dark things that I had done. And then she talked about feeling dirtier on the inside than she did on the outside. You know, and for the first time in my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard somebody put to words how I felt. You guys, I identified, right? And then she talked about having a spiritual awakening as a result, as the result of taking these steps. And as a result of that, that today she felt cleaner on the inside than she did on the outside. And like I said before, I didn't know what you had when I got here. But at that moment she said that, I knew exactly what you had. And my God, I wanted it. And so it was pedal to the metal here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had this willingness that I hadn't had before. And then I'd sit among you in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I would feel safe, you know, and then I would have that feeling sometime afterwards, I'd have that feeling of feeling safe that I would experience sitting in the room on my way to the meeting in anticipation of sitting among you, you know, and then pretty soon it would extend, you know, from before the meeting and during the meeting to after the meeting and then in between meetings, you know, my life started to get better. You know, I think willingness is everything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the old timers would tell me that, right? And you know, here in the Akron area, we have, and I'm sure you guys probably do too, but, you know, the Akron Intergroup, we have these golden books, you know, and in one of them, it talks about, you know, sanctity. And Father John Doe, you know, he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He would write these books and he would talk about, you know, sanctity is not being a saint, right? It's not what we think it is. We typically think, you know, we can't be saints, you know, but it really, what sanctity really means is, you know, approval of God, having that God's approval. And how we get God's approval is through the willingness. It's so key here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to tell you a little bit about, you know, Rick. He was a Pied Piper in Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew, he loved AA. He started young people's meetings on the west side of Cleveland. He had a following of young people, and I'm not saying that's good or bad, but he had this, you know, all these young people that he just was so enthusiastic, right? He had that personality and he was so in love with Alcoholics Anonymous because of the transformation we find here. And he became very sick from the drink when he picked up, and he became a wet brain. You know, after 9 years of sobriety, he got very sick, and I had a front row seat to watch this thing rob him of everything he loved and valued, especially Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you, he made it back into the rooms, but I want to paint that picture for you a little bit, because he would come back through the doors and his pants would be around his ankles and he'd have no idea. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys would scoop him up, you'd get him situated, and you'd bring him into the rooms and you'd sit him down, and you guys would all bring him coffee and you'd all say hi to him and talk and welcome him, you know. And I'll be forever grateful, because we don't shoot our wounded here. And unfortunately, nobody was home. He'd look back through you and he'd be, you know, lost and in his own little world. And perhaps the meeting was going on and someone was sharing and he'd be laughing or talking to himself, right? And he caught me at a lucid moment and he said, "Christina, I got to tell you something. I got 1 foot in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and 1 foot out, and I can't get back." And I had no idea how profound that statement was when he made it. And I was in school at the time because you taught me I could be useful. And I'm studying at Cleveland State University. My children are in daycare on campus. And, you know, it's a Thursday night and it's Rick's birthday and he's supposed to come over. We don't see him often because he's so, so sick. But he's going to come over and see his boys for his birthday. And I'm going to make dinner. And I'm at school and it's 8 a.m. and I have a full day of classes. And I have this thought, I'm going to cut class, because that's what I do. I'm a quitter. I automatically go there. And I have this thought, I'm going to cut class. And I had this pull. I felt this pull to be with him. I can't explain it, right? Like I knew, I just knew. And then I heard your voice and your voice said, "No, Christina, when we make a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, we see through to our commitments in and out of the rooms." You know, and I stayed the course because you guys have never steered me wrong. And all day long, I felt that pull. I had that thought. And then I would hear your voice. And 4 o'clock, I'm leaving class and I pick up my boys and I go home and I make dinner and Rick doesn't show. And I call his mother and I make some phone calls. I try to get a hold of him and I get a hold of no one. And no news is good news. And the next day I go to school and I come home and I'm getting ready for my home group that night. And I'm getting ready to walk out the door. And this is before I have a cell phone. And I get a phone call. And it was the phone call. It was his mother calling me to let me know that Rick had passed away. And he had carved his initials, you guys. So the coroner's report says that he carved his initials in a 9mm bullet and shot himself in the head. And what I can tell you about that is this, that there are no bad examples in Alcoholics Anonymous because I can learn from everyone. And I learned from him because I know exactly what he did and didn't do. I know he stopped going to his meetings. He stopped picking up his new guys, calling his sponsor. He stopped, doing all the things you taught him to do. He stopped taking these steps. And he believed that great lie that he could one day drink safely again. And I'll never forget the banner that hung behind the podium of my first home group. It said, "Watch well your beginnings. The results will manage themselves." And life went on for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and me and the boys, it was a struggle. It was really hard for them. But life got better for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that made life for the boys better. Right. And 3 years after Rick died, my sponsor at the time, not Beth Gordon, and not my current sponsor, but my first sponsor, and she was wonderful. I loved her dearly, but she called me up and she said, "Christina, I just got to tell you, I'm going to tell you that I'm quitting Alcoholics Anonymous." And I thought, whoa, like, I didn't know you could do that. And the reason why I tell you that is that, oh my gosh, I floundered and became self-directed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't recommend that. It was a very long time before I got another sponsor. And I was quite the mess when she got me. the big book tells us that we have a way out, you guys, upon which we can absolutely agree, upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. You have my solution. My experience has always been consistent. As I take these steps and practice these principles, all my answers come. And I don't need to know all the answers. I don't need to know how to do everything. I just need to suit up and show up. You know, God always meets me where I come with willingness, and he takes over. And the best part about that is I don't have to be invested in the outcome. It's none of my business. I want to tell you a little bit about, you know, my boys. They're great young men. They're grown. They're 30 and 28. They did have their struggles when they were younger. And so they had all these struggles, and I would later find out that they would be diagnosed with a pretty serious illness, that there is no cure. There's just treatment. And I was devastated. And I started to wallow in some heavy self-pity until you kicked me in my fanny and you made me pull up my big girl pants because you taught me about footwork. So I got busy and I researched about their illness, and I became very educated in the area of medicine concerning their illness. And you taught me to stand at the door and shake hands, right? You taught me to follow directions and one foot in front of the other. And as a result, I was able to, become an advocate for my children. I learned the girl who couldn't speak to people, I could talk to doctors in a medical language to get them the care they needed. And I'll be forever grateful for that. I want to tell you a minute about my God. I never struggled with the God piece. You know, I think when my drinking took off, I think I just put God on a shelf. I couldn't serve two gods, but I had that, that void that, I was running the show. It was my ego. And and self-will run riot, right? My alcoholism. And so my first prayer in the beginning of my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, that God helped me prayer that I said in the beginning, from all the coincidences that turned into God moments to having the eyes to see God's hand at work in my life, and all the surrenders, right? The big ones and the little ones, and they continue, surrenders continue today. And, you know, when I'm connected to my God, you guys, I'm connected to you and my fellows. And when I'm connected to you and my fellows through love, service, and action in Alcoholics Anonymous or out, I'm connected, you know, to my God. You connect me to my God. And I was able to reestablish that relationship with my higher power. And I finally realized that I had undergone a profound alteration in my reaction to life. I met my husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things I loved about him was his enthusiasm for AA. You know, this enthusiasm is important. It's infectious. It's so important. And I need to show up enthusiastic because this thing saves lives. It's transformational. And we have this wonderful AA life. We do the deal together. And, you know, I thought when I got here, I was going to get the happily ever after and the white picket fence, but that is not what you promise us here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I get a set of spiritual tools sufficient for anything that I have come to deal with in life on life's terms. But more importantly, it has been sufficient enough for those who have gone before me, living life on life's terms in situations I have yet to experience. Those examples are so powerful for us. You know, those old timers, those people experience things that I have yet to experience. Gosh, what else do I want to tell you? My life is good today. I want to tell you a little bit about, you know, that old timer in Toronto, Canada. His name was Frankie O, and I don't know if any of you have ever heard him speak, but when he would talk about waking up, being awake and present in life and in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a powerful message for me because I can just miss it. I can miss the moment. I get caught up in all the fears of tomorrow or the regrets of yesterday that I can just miss being right here with you. And I don't want to miss anything today. You know, I don't want to miss my sons when they experience joy and success. You know, it's a big deal. I don't want to miss being present for my niece when she needs me, when she calls me auntie, or when she tells me her wonderful stories. For example, about the little girl who burped up a cupcake in class. I don't want to miss the thing. I don't want to miss the girls walking in the doors. You know, I want to be present today. I also want to just share with you that, you know, I was unemployable when I got to you. And after some time in Alcoholics Anonymous, my kids were very young. I got a job at their special school as the lunch lady. And I was working as a lunch lady. And then a job opened up to work with the kids that had these special needs, direct care with these kids. And, you know, they wanted me to apply. And I applied, I interviewed, and I got the job. And, you know, I worked and eventually, you know, I walked across the stage at Cleveland State University with my mom and my dad and my husband in attendance, and I got my degree. And I worked in mental health for 21 years working with these kids. And I believe that this agency saw, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous saw you and me. And that's how I got on that path to work with wonderful kids. And then things started to change. I felt God pulling me in another direction. And the long and short of that is that after 21 years of working in the mental health field, I turned in my pad of paper and my my textbooks and my my pencils and pens for a hard hat and steel toe boots. And now I'm a steel worker, and I am in a millwright training program. I'm going to be a mechanic in the millwright, if a mechanic in the steel mills, if you don't know what a millwright is. And who would have ever thought, you know, at 50 years of age that I would just change it up? But you guys, you taught me to face my fears, you know, and I can deal with life on life's terms today. And, you know, it's the best thing. It was the best thing. I'm so happy learning all these things and meeting all these people and just taking the road, you know, that God is having me on. I want to tell you, my dear beloved longtime sponsor, Beth Gordon, she used to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous being the greatest love story ever written and ever told. And you guys, isn't it true? From our earliest beginnings at bedside, to our humble neighborhood meetings and home groups, to gatherings such as Founders Day, you know, it's one alcoholic sharing his or her experience, strength, and hope with another that we finally come home. So I like to close with a little story about a boy who goes to Sunday church with his mom, and they walk into this beautiful stone cathedral, and he looks up at the beautiful stained glass windows in that church, and he says, "Mommy, who are those glass people?" And his mother looks down at him and says, "Why, those are the saints." And that little boy the next day goes to school, and he's still in awe from the day before. And his teacher asks him what he did over the weekend, and he proudly announces, "I saw the saints." And his teacher asks him, "Who are the saints?" And the little boy replies, "The saints, they're the ones that let the light in." So I want to thank all of you for always being present in the moment for this alcoholic. And I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for letting the light in. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine.